as the one guy you might expect to never say that, I'm saying it too. So yeah, something happens for sure.
Hey, welcome to the first official episode of the Unfamous Podcast. It's a show about making a life in music and other related subjects. I'm Paul Edwards.
Let me bring you up to speed.
I've been planning on doing this for a couple of years now, but life's been busy. Better late than never, though, so here we go. First off, who's Paul Edwards and why should you care? Well, I'm not really sure you should, but if you got a little bit of extra time left in your schedule and you decide to subscribe and tune in every once in a while, you'll no doubt get to know me a little bit better and hear some of my stories. Hopefully you'll hear some of the crazier ones. There's definitely a lot of those. Whether they be about me as a musician, writing songs and playing shows, me as an engineer and producer working with other artists, my experiences working for various music companies, and even helping create a controversial artificial intelligent music technology. For now, I'll just say that I'm a musician and an audio engineer, and I've worked in the music industry for many years. I'm looking forward to sharing a bit of my knowledge and shooting the shit with like-minded folks. I by no means have all the answers, but that's part of the fun, right?
All right.
Today I'm at my studio on the island of Montreal, where so far I've recorded most of the interviews.
Montreal is Montreal, right? It is what it is. But
I'll also be traveling to different locations, as well as connecting with people on the phone and the internet.
What the f*** is the internet?
If you want more info on each episode, like show notes and things like that, or to see behind the scenes, or if you want to leave us any feedback, please visit unfamouspodcast.com or hit us on Facebook or Instagram at unfamouspodcast. We also have Twitter, Unfamous Pod. This is all a work in progress and will no doubt evolve over time. So just be patient and bear with me. Be gentle. And for fuck's sake, love yourself today. And always try to not be a prick and never put salt in your eyes. On today's episode, we have John Mullane. This one's what I call a 12-incher, clocking in around 60 minutes with a side A and B. But don't worry, you don't have to flip shit. Just sit back, relax, and don't forget to stretch. And before I forget, I'd like to thank Restaurant Lafleur. Yum yum.
And someone should have picked that.
All right, let's get started. John Mullane is a musician and producer best known as the frontman of East Coast indie rock band In Flight Safety. Over their 15-year or so run, In Flight Safety have released 3 albums and 2 EPs. They've toured extensively, including Europe, the US, and Canada, at countless festivals, clubs, TV, and radio stations. The band's songs have appeared on various TV shows like The Office, Degrassi Next Gen, Chuck, The Vampire Diaries, and Rookie Blue.
Rookie Blue!
They've been nominated for Junos, which if you don't already know are the Canadian Grammys, and they've even won a few East Coast Music Awards along the way. Over the past few years, John has slowed down touring largely to start a family and be able to spend more time producing other artists. John's what we call a songwriter's producer. He gets his hands dirty and can help with everything from songwriting, arrangement, performance, and he's also a solid mixing engineer too. His musical chops are impressive and include, but are not limited to, guitar, piano, drums, and of course vocals. When he's not producing bands, he also composes for TV and film. To be honest, I had a bit of a hard time deciding who I'd have as my first guest, but in the end, John just made sense. We share a lot in common, and we're in similar places in our personal lives and musical careers. I have a lot of musical friends I respect and admire, and they'll hopefully appear on this podcast at some point, provided I can find those compromising Polaroids I have in storage. Not only is John one of the more musical guys I know, he's also one of my oldest friends. We met the first day my family moved to New Brunswick from Quebec. I was wandering around the neighborhood on my own, as you do, a 5-year-old unaccompanied by an adult, ready for something bad to happen so he could be immortalized in the Moncton News. Of course, this was back in the 80s in a pre-internet, pre-dial-up world. Our lives would eventually diverge in late childhood when I moved back to Montreal, but somehow we managed to stay close, probably due to the fact that we were both lucky enough to get the music bug and ended up being musicians and later music producers. Perhaps unlucky if you ask our parents, but here we are. It's actually pretty interesting how similar our paths ended up being, not least that we ended up becoming fathers within months of each other. We chat a little bit about fatherhood too, but you'll have to wait till the end of the episode and the outtakes to hear that stuff. I caught up with John at his studio in Halifax, and this conversation was recorded through Skype, so you'll have to forgive the audio connection. Overall, it holds together, but there's still the occasional dropouts and glitches and overall compromised audio. We discussed John's history and career, production philosophies and strategies, word-of-mouth marketing, stepping back from social media in favor of engaging in art and doing what's most important, writing great songs, the benefits of pre-production, and much, much more. Without further ado, here's my conversation with the conversationalist himself, John Mullane. So, John Mullane.
Hey.
Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Things are good?
Everything's good, yeah.
Keeping busy?
Busy with 2 children and some projects, some musical projects on the go.
How's that working out for you, balancing the family life and the producer, engineer, singer, songwriter?
Yeah, I don't know that it's working yet. not sure that it is. It remains to be seen if it's working, but I think it's working. It's so new for me, but my clients have all been really good when things have had to take a couple days because of children's stuff. They've been also really good. So no complaints over here.
Yeah, I guess it helps when your clients or the people that you're working with are understanding in terms of like having a flexible schedule. And I think that comes like at a 50-50. There's some people in the industry, depending on where you're working, it's by the minute and sets start at this time and the end at this time and studio time is fixed. And then there's the other side where musicians are pretty lax and they don't show up on time and dates can change and they're flaky and you have to reschedule. So, maybe it works in our favor. Having to be flexible with kids.
Well, I think because I come distinctly and, uniquely from a musician's point of view, I do take a lot of that. And, we can touch on this too more as we talk, but I take a lot of that process and a lot of that mindset and I tailor things to musicians. So the way that I work is not like, oh, January 16th to January 21, everything has to get done in these 5 days. It's like, I know that musicians do things kind of slowly but surely over time. So I use that as part of my process and it kind of helps me one way in that it allows me to kind of let musicians never feel tied to one idea until we're done. But then it also, of course, to increase the amount of time it takes to finish a project. But I'm actually okay with that because I'm so used to it.
Whatever it takes to make sure that the client's happy and that you're happy with the product that you put out.
That's right. And I offer this process as a natural thing because I come from a world where I'd record vocals for a record that's supposed to be out in 6 months. And I'd come home from Toronto or something and I go, it's not good. This song is no good. And then there's no recourse. And I don't want to ever put someone in that position. So I always offer an out. It's like, come back and we'll do it again. Or we'll just do it at another studio and send me the vocals. Because I'd rather have a vocal recorded that's like slightly degraded from the way I would do it or different than and have it be right for the song than have it, be so perfectly done fidelity-wise. So that I've always been that way with making art. So I also offer that to the artists I work with.
Absolutely. Like I think about that every once in a while, like going back to maybe when I was studying some of the engineering stuff back, a million years ago, I think someone was asking a question, hey, do you have to be a musician to be a good engineer and vice versa? And the answer was, well, it helps, but no, you don't. I have to remember he's down there. I'm so used to being in the studio every day, all the time with different people that it's just, it's so natural, but this is their time. This is their few weeks or months in the studio. And this is a big thing. And maybe they've been writing these songs for years. So I think it's like such a huge skill to be a musician as well when you're a producer and an engineer. And I'm not saying it can't be done, but it would be so odd not to have that perspective.
Or at least not to be sensitive to it, because like you said, musicians come into a session and a session can be as much more informal with me. It's usually like one-on-one and have some coffee. Then we just start recording a bit, try some stuff. Like I don't do formalities very well. In fact, that's probably the worst thing I am at doing anything is formal recording. It's kind of a little or more informal because I like that creative vibe you get from just kind of a friendship into a workplace. But, being sensitive to an artist's needs is tricky because if you're not an artist, you won't know the amount of anxiety and stress that's gone into each and every song. And I'm sensitive to that because I lived it. And I also lived it in the sense that it was my livelihood if I didn't make great songs and I wasn't working. So I know that sense of anxiety that comes with going into the studio. So I can diffuse it by letting them know that nothing is ever done until they're happy. And that saves me a lot of stressed-out artists.
And that's not something you hear very often, or at least I haven't heard it from many other people, many producers or engineers.
No, I don't think it's very typical because it's atypical because it's hard to make a living doing just that because you'd have to cut things off. But the artists that I choose to work with are in addition to other things that I do, which is the film and TV composing and some other day jobby music stuff I do where I record covers from the past and repurpose them in a modern sense for a company. And I do library music for CTV and Bell. So in addition to that, I can kind of game the system in my favor, which is like making songs from an artist point of view and not from like a record company point of view.
So one, I guess the more commercial work will feed the more artistic projects.
That's right. Smart. Because I can only charge so much for a record from an artist. First of all, unless the artist is on a major label, they're not going to want to pay that much, but I charge per song and I do not cap a timeline on that. And some songs never make it past the 50% deposit I charge up front. they just die on the vine like a year later. And that's fine because that's what I come from. I come from a school of making art, and my job is to help these young artists or old artists, just age isn't really a thing, I guess, help them realize their art for their albums and make them as great as possible. So that's the way I do it. I charge per song and not per chunk of time.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up too, because I know a lot of people starting out too, and even well into their careers, I'm like, well, do I charge per hour? Do I charge per song? Do I charge per day, per half day, per project? And I think the further along we go, you realize that you're going to get a much better project, you know, out of something about not putting, you know, those timelines on thing and making sure that the artist isn't watching the clock. But are there any clauses? Because I've worked with people too, like, you know, you do some free projects and the fact that there's no cutoff and it keeps going forever. But you say, I charge per song, but well, there's a limit. You get X amount of days, or is there really no end to it? Or do you?
There's really no end to me because I have a process in place that I developed over 20 years, I think. So maybe over 19 years. So the process is gospel, and the process involves pre-production, involves checks and balances. It involves a way to deliver notes, a way to come up with agreements on parts. So the whole process I've developed is just what I use to produce a record or produce a song. So in that process, there's checks and balances. So, you know, if something doesn't advance through that process, there's something else wrong. It's not usually musical, or maybe something musically is wrong, but we fix it. So I never really run into problems like that. Originally, I had some clauses in my contract about limiting the amount of mixed notes and stuff like that. But I have found that if I do the process correctly and stick to the process, I don't really have a problem with that usually. Even I usually tend to have more notes than the artist.
Yeah.
Be like, yeah, there's a synth missing at this chorus. And you guys don't know yet, but I'm going to find it and send it to you. And then I'll do it that day and send it back to them. And they go, oh, I see what you mean. So like, it's usually me who's at the end, just nitpicking a little bit more those last couple of days. So, cause artists are often like, oh, vocals up and down. And that's easy for me to add a mix note and takes an hour.
And I guess it works in everybody's favor, but it also works in your favor too, because being a producer that kind of wears a lot of hats, we haven't really talked about your skill set yet, but you're kind of a turnkey system in terms of where you can help with the songwriting, you can help with the arrangement, you can also perform pretty much most of the instruments on the record if you need to, and you can also, you know, do the engineering and mixing. So I guess
that's just it, and that's the goal, to do all that stuff. I'm only able to do that because I'm 40 years old now, and I've had the experience, like you said, playing guitar long enough that it comes very quickly, or even if I need to play drums, I'll do that usually on electric drums, and then I'll resample them later because I could work in the MIDI a lot faster. But I can come up with drum parts and patterns, so it's just really helpful to have that turnkey system. And I even extend the turnkey system into my experience in the music business. At the end of making a record, I offer a bit of informal help to get artists to the right people.
Well, that's huge too, because I mean, a lot of people don't think about it, especially young artists too. They'll be like, well, we put out a record, record the record and it's done, and then we'll become famous, or we'll get a deal, or you know, we'll go on tour. And then everyone's sitting there without a lot of advice saying, well, what are the next steps? How do we book shows? How do we book the right shows? How do we not saturate our local market? You know, like, how do we get to the next step? How do we promote our music? How do we get our music in the right hands of people? So that must be a huge, that could be a business. I mean, I'm sure it is, you know, in a lot of places, but I would see that being more, maybe that's just me not trusting the people who would be on the marketing side of things, maybe being a little sketchy. Maybe that's from experience too, but having someone that takes you from the start to the end of their project, and then someone they trust, hopefully as the producer, then you could sort of give them that advice. That seems like to be an invaluable.
Yeah, I think it does contribute to why people come to me. They know that they're going to get a certain kind of reinforcement in terms of mentoring and management almost. And that helps them get started. And it's in my best interest that their record and their EPs and their songs are promoted in the best possible way. So it's also in my interest that we get it the right reinforcement in terms of if we get the right people in the press or the right people in the media, and help get labels connected to artists and managers and agents connected to artists. And it also strengthens my relationships with managers, agents, and labels, which is something I've strengthened through in-flight safety. But because we're not as busy on the road, it helps me keep those relationships strong,
right?
Because I'm working with other people. So I really appreciate that fact of working with other people. It doesn't always have to be about in-flight safety and me. And saying, hey, we've got a tour coming up. Do you know another band we could get? You know, I just like, I'm not always talking to agents as much as I would have. So now I have a cause to keep in touch with my agent friends and my management friends. And I really like that.
Oh, sweet. some producers and engineers and studios. I guess maybe it's more the studios, you know, like the by the hour, book by the day. They'll just kind of take any work that comes along.
Yes.
But it seems like your methodology and your, I guess, the ethics involved and your philosophy in terms of recording and being a mentor to certain artists probably limit who you say yes and no to.
That's absolutely right. It's a really astute question because I do not take on everyone. That does serve two things. One is my own taste is important to me. I don't work on everything because if I worked on everything, then I wouldn't be special in terms of what I can do. I don't like that feeling of taking on everything. I've never liked it because I like to work on one thing a lot. So that works in my favor. The other thing that it serves is people know that if they come to me, they're going to get a certain level of sound reinforcement in a certain process. So they have to be into it and they're well aware of it before they contact me because they would have talked to other people or they know about what I do. And I like knowing that the records that I make will get to the right people in the industry. So some of them don't go anywhere, but the majority of them do find like a small label or some good press through the contacts that I've been able to amass. So I think that's really valuable. And I think people see that. And I think that's one way that I can get ahead.
You said there they would have already known that before coming to me. And other than you've been in the public eye and on radio and won awards and toured around a lot, I guess it gets back to promotion and word of mouth and recommendations from peers. Is that the way that you kind of go through your professional life and working on music?
Yeah, that's another really astute question. And you're exactly right. I don't have a website for my engineering and producing because I have tried to curate more of a word of mouth knowledge of who I am. So it does really, at the moment, that seems to be working. So I plan to do more of a kind of a sort of the soft release of my producing stuff is kind of 20 years in the making, right? So it sort of feels weird to just be like, okay, hey, everyone, I'm a producer now. It's like, well, I always kind of have been. So I think I'm just kind of going with this more nuanced approach to marketing, which is word of mouth. And people do know who I am in the community here because of my position in the band and as a community member in the music scene. Now, whether or not this will extend beyond Halifax, because most of the people I work with are local, would be the next goal. But part of me really likes working at home because that's where I live. So mm-hmm. I don't feel any accentuated need to go work in Los Angeles right now. Maybe later, but I'm happy with being an outsider or something. That's how I founded my career. It's not being an outsider.
Maybe being a big fish in a smaller pond in terms of being in a secondary market. And I'm talking about secondary market, not Toronto, not LA, not New York, and not Nashville, and not London. So basically all those other places I would consider as a secondary market. You're lucky in terms of being, and I'm sure you've maybe thought it out or maybe it was all organic, but you're in a place where there's tons of creative people.
Yeah, there really is. And in a way, like I don't even look at it like big fish in a small pond. I just look at it as a person who makes art and I like being on the outside of the city centers because there's a certain conformity to being in the city centers. Now there are lots of great artists in the cities. Obviously that's where some of the best artists are, but there's a certain conformity to process and to needing to rush things out to market, stuff like that. There's a conformity or there's a little bit of a pressure in that regard. And I formed my career. The most success I ever had in my career was moving to a small town and just writing for a couple of years with a band. And then the band became successful after that. It wasn't before that. It had nothing to do with Toronto or Halifax. It was just the music. And that early experience of creating music on the outside of what was contemporary or what was cool really informed the rest of my life. So I always remember that was what it was being on the outside and working on the craft. It wasn't anything about being in the right place at the right time. Now, the right place, right time stuff came later for us, and we did need to move to Halifax. Couldn't move to anything smaller than that to make it all work. And we traveled all the time, as you know, to get to Toronto, Vancouver, New York, traveling all the time. So that was necessary for the business. But this is the music business, and without music, there is no business. So I've always put 90% of my focus on music, and that's really served me well. And I try to instill that in the bands I work on. I tell them to get off social media. It's like, you don't need to be on there right now. We don't have a record. You can have fun with it. I let them have fun with it, and I don't make any rules per se, but I do try to point their focus on influences, musical references that we're going to bring to the table, what working on songs daily, and try to let them naturally come across the fact that social media is secondary.
Well, it's so hard too, especially these days, and we're all guilty of it to a certain extent, of going after the likes and liking that affirmation, and with all your friends checking in on you, and you can check in on your friends and see what's going on in their lives and support. Everyone is very supportive, but marketing has always creeped me out a little bit and made me feel a little dirty. I mean, I've had a website for years, but I've never paid for advertisement. I've never gone that route, and I've always tried to work with the artists that I wanted to work with. And, you know, sometimes you have to take a pay cut to do that. And, but you know, and if it's not always the music that you're in love with, I've always enjoyed working with the people, and the people are always coming from a really nice and good and honest place in terms of just wanting to make and create art. I like how you're just going with mostly people's recommendations, and then maybe people find your records of the other people you worked on, and they get in touch. Well, who's the producer, and contact you because they like your work. And that kind of just makes me think of all these, 1,000 true fans, instead of buying Instagram followers and buying Facebook likes and all that. Like, where does that really get you, other than maybe trying to boost your ego at least in the eyes of others? And it's just really basically, how many people do you actually want, or who do you want actually following you? It's people that are actually interested in you. And that made me think of something years and years ago, because people might not know, but we've known each other since we were young kids. And I followed your career over the years too.
Yep.
And one of the things, when MySpace was actually a thing, and one of my bands was getting off the ground, and we were being pursued by major labels and all that sort of thing. And one of the things before we had signed with anybody was, we're trying to increase our friends on MySpace. And I remember it was everyone's job to go home every night and add other bands that they know's friends, and to increase our numbers, so we would look more attractive to the major labels. And, you know, to a certain extent it worked, but I remember the advice that you gave me was, do it organically, because those people aren't going to come to your shows. Those people aren't really going to listen to your music. So I think that was back in the MySpace days, but it applies today with people buying Instagram followers and Facebook likes, because those aren't real people that are going to actually help your career.
And it's not going to serve you. Other, like you said, it does serve an ego thing, and you know, it's a free country, so to each its own, but it doesn't really serve your career, because other people will make the connection. It's like, well, how can they have 1 million views on this YouTube video, but they only have 800 people on Twitter and 600 people on Instagram? It doesn't make any sense. Like, unless you had a hit song, and there's no mention of a hit song. It's just, so, you know, people know. So it ends up just looking bad in terms of, if you're doing it for the industry purposes. If you're doing it for yourself, then that's great. And you can enjoy that, those likes and stuff, and get a modicum of joy from that. But I just think it's, especially for people today starting out, artists starting out, doesn't matter what age you are, there's a sense that you have to engage in social media constantly. And that is false. That's a myth. The myth is strong, but it's, what you have to do is make music, and it has to be great. So whatever life experiences you need to take part in to make great music is what you have to do, or whatever research you have to do. Like the amount of bands that I forced to go and listen to records they haven't heard yet, not necessarily my picks, but ones that I need them to go and, where does this come from? Where does this aesthetic come from? Let's figure it out. Go listen to that. Like, have you listened to this? And they go, no. Okay, I'll check it out. And I force bands to do stuff that I did organically when I was in my 20s. But we also benefited when we were in our 20s, because we're the same age. We benefited from a lot more downtime, a lot more reflection. So it's a little bit judgmental, but it's a way for me to help young artists or new artists just get ahead, by engaging in art and not in social media. Because social media, in most cases, it doesn't serve your art. It's a good way to get feedback, a good way to get the word out. And I use social media all the time to just simply be like, here's what I'm working on. And I don't use it for much else, but I do a lot of like, hey, check out what I'm working on. Maybe you guys will find this interesting. And I think that's another way that even me saying I don't do marketing, but I do that. And that's a real way that I get the word out about what I'm doing. So I can't knock it. But in terms of young artists who have just a few followers, there's no reason to pursue inflating your followers. There's every reason in the world to be reflecting on your songs and trying to make better ones and make them better.
Yeah, for sure. And I think we grew up at the perfect time because we kind of knew the world before the internet, and maybe the internet came out in our late teens, early 20s. Yeah. So we benefited from, like you said, the downtime and actually reading a lot more books and listening to a lot more music and seeking things out and getting things from the recommendations of really close friends saying like, hey, this is cool. Check this out. Listen to this band, that kind of thing. And also being able to sit down with an instrument. But you know, a lot of people just want the instant thing. Like, how do I get success? How do I get, I just want the win. And how do I buy it? Uh-huh. How do I circumnavigate the hard work to get there?
Yeah. And there's no better way. What we grew up with, it wasn't better. It's really ageist at times. And you hear that in the late 90s, it was like, but there was more time for reflection. And I can say that because I'm in the new world now. Like, I'm not as solitary and kind of reflective as I was, because I don't feel like I have time to be. That might have to do with aging and having kids and stuff too. But I found with smartphones and things like that, I had to put them away. Like, I had to actually put them away in terms of like intellectually, no, okay, this has to go away in order for me to work on the record today. So I find it's more challenging, but at the same time, I would have benefited from having more influences that young people have today by doing research on the internet. So there's the upside to it as well that we didn't get. We had to like rely on the records that we had and our friends had. And that was challenging at times because you're kind of stuck in certain styles.
Yeah.
So I'm sure you'd agree with that. So it's, you know, it's there's no right way, but I do recommend like all my new artists, like to not be too concerned with social media. And you'll find that it doesn't really matter. And I had the epiphany just a couple weeks ago, and it's such a basic epiphany, but I had this weird epiphany where everyone else probably already thinks this, but I had this thing where I internalized this thought and I was like, the internet is not life. It's just a tool. And we have this weird way in our brains to think about the internet as life. It's like, we're on Facebook, we're talking, you and I are talking over, you know, smartphones right now, you're texting your partner, but really all that is just tools to help your life. They're just little assists. And I had this epiphany where I was like, oh my God, I've been thinking about this wrong. I'm sitting on Facebook going like, I'm living life. It's like, I don't know that I'm totally living life. I'm just kind of, you know, making plans to see people, making plans to do things. And it's like, it really is just this really complex tool. And because it got so all-encompassing, it kind of tricked us. Like, you could be off Facebook for a week. Nothing's going to change. You'll be fine. But you just don't, you feel like it's much bigger than that.
Yeah, you feel like you're missing out.
That's right. And it's, so if we keep in mind that it's just a tool, and the email is just a tool, and text is just a tool to assist in our lives, we can kind of game the system. We can get out of the rat race a bit. And I'm trying to like do this a little more in practice. I haven't quite done it in practice, but I've just sort of had the thought the other day. It's like, this is not real. Like, when I play video games, it's not real. It's like, this is just me diffusing real life, taking a moment of break. But playing the game is sort of, you know, not quite real. So I'm having this kind of philosophical reckoning with myself where I'm seeing that the internet, because it's everywhere, it's on our smartphones, every app we use, it's really just small part of you living your life, and it feels so big. So I'm trying to reconcile these things, and that's going to help me stay more focused on my art, I think, in the future.
Nice. Yeah. And it's about discipline, right?
Yeah.
Just to clarify, like, I definitely have no problems with modern technology, and I worked in tech for most of my career. So I'm totally down with that side of things. And on the other side of that thing is what you touched upon, is this option paralysis that people talk about.
Yes.
You know, just too many things. It's like, even in production of music, you know, like, it's not committing to anything until the end. And the whole Frank Zappa joke, let's fix it in the shrink wrap. It completely, you know, like, it completely applies to today times 1,000, you know. Just
sure.
There's always these things to take up our time and to distract us from working on our art. And then there's all these things, like, we have access to all these plugins, and maybe we never finish anything because it can always be changed. It can always be tweaked.
That's right. So you always have to have like, keep that in check. And now the myriad options you have with VSTs and stuff is great, because then you can be more creative. But there's a lot of people who would argue that limitations are important in the studio, like picking and choosing a few instruments to start, having an aesthetic, and you know, not, we could use any bass on this track. We should try all of them. It's like, that's not always a good plan. And a lot of great producers who I've followed would advocate for limitations, but build them right into the process. This is the room we're doing it in. Figure it out. Or go somewhere, bring a bunch of gear. This is the gear that we're going to mostly use. And then you can go and polish later. But, you know, those are great tools, using limitations to create, your art rather than, well, I can play any guitar, but it's like, what guitar feels right to you? Like that's, those are decisions that are very important that often can, people don't make or forget to, because there's so many options.
Yeah. There's a engineering friend of mine that I've known for quite a long time. And we've studied that stuff at the same time and worked on a bunch of albums together. And he came up with this thing a few years back where he's like, instead of wanting to get back to tape machines or maybe recording on a radar system where I'm limited to a certain amount of tracks, he's like, I'm just going to use Pro Tools like it is a tape machine. And like, I only have this EQ or these EQs to use, and I only have these compressors, and I only have a certain amount of tracks, and I'm going to stick to that. So,
yeah.
You know, it, like, it's again, getting back to that thing, like these are all tools, and it's depending, just because you have all these options that you can use it and force yourself to certain limitations. It's not always easy to stick to that, because when you can go in and tweak something or change something, like you said, at the last minute, sure, go ahead and fix something, but sticking to these limitations can be good, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah. And I mean, this is a concept that goes back long before you and I were born, but I think it was Brian Eno had the oblique strategies that were something they used in making art. When you hit creative blocks, you'd pull out a card and it would be like, just use the theremin on this part or something.
Right.
They have just these weird strategies to kind of force you into a limitation that would help you. You know, it would be a way of getting through a creative block. And that, limitations are huge, because like unlimited choice is really tricky. Doesn't really get you too far.
Absolutely not. We talked a bit about your creative process there. Would there be any tips and tricks in terms of keeping a project on track? You know, you work with an artist from the get-go, like pre-prod. I know more and more people are starting to appreciate pre-prod. Maybe if they're working on their own or in their own jam spaces or producing music on their own, the lines are always blurred. Like, I'm the artist, I'm the songwriter, I'm also engineering my own stuff, but you're kind of doing your pre-prod and recording at the same time, but you're turning a demo into a finished product, let's say. But
yeah.
What kind of tips would you give to people in terms of saying, we're going to sit down and this is pre-prod?
I draw a lot of parallels in my process between making a film and making a record, playing a live show and doing live theater. Why do I do that? I don't know. I think I've always thought in a filmic kind of way, and I have connections to film. I've been passionate about film and TV and since I was a kid, and I've worked in it a bit as a composer and also on set. I have lots of friends who work on set and actor friends over the years and stuff like that. So I've always been able to draw parallels between the two. So for me, I've always been the producer in my area anyway, that's been the most strict about pre-production. I feel like pre-production should be like 70% of your record. That's because you would never start rolling camera or rolling tape on a $1 million film without the right script. And although people do it all the time. We've all seen those films.
Yeah.
It happens all the time. And I'm just like, that's bananas. Just don't start filming until you have a script. And the best movies do exactly that. You know, the more you read and the more you read the trivia and the Wikipedia about the films you love, it's like, yeah, this took 7 years to come to the point where we could film it for 4 months. Everything is the script, and the script is the songs to me. Like, if you don't have the stories built and the right characters and the right songs, then there's really no point. I don't really want to roll tape. And what's the point of me doing that? So I'm pretty stringent with that. And I make people go through quite a long process of pre-production where I challenge, why is the bass guitar playing eighths here? Why isn't he playing quarter notes here? I don't get this. Why are there 12 drum patterns in one song? That's a lot. You know, I can count, notwithstanding fill-ins, like, why are there so many patterns? So I go through and I really do have a process that I developed through working with in-flight safety and then now a lot of artists over the years. And I have a whole process of making sure songs are kind of ready for recording. And I think that is one of my biggest assets is that process. It all comes from being in a career band for so long. And while I was in that band, I was always doing stuff with other people, like writing or recording or doing sessions for other people or helping friends with their songs, or they were helping me. And so that developed naturally out of being a songwriter, composer, and band leader. And the thing that I'll mention is people don't talk about a lot is the band leader part of what I do is almost a whole separate process where you have to be able to take four people in a room and give them good directions on how to get this song fixed. That's served me really well as a producer, and it's taken years and years of rehearsals that have gone poorly and some that have gone well. And there's a whole layer of process that people don't talk about. And it's between songwriting and I guess recording. And that's the pre-production. And sort of, it's almost between the end of pre-production and the beginning of pre-production. There's a whole layer of what I call presentation and design, like in your song. What's your presentation of your parts? And How do you have the symmetry working in your songs? What's the design like in the drum pattern? Where are the patterns? Where are they not patterns? Where are we changing the patterns to give more tension? And where are we relieving tension? Where are we dropping out? So there's this whole layer that I go through with bands. It's kind of catches them off guard. I call it design because I'm doing design. I'm like, there's so much bass there. It's getting in the way of the vocal. So that's not really songwriting. That's
the arrangement, but I like that. I think that's probably the first time I've heard anyone refer to it as design. I really like that.
Yeah. You're doing design. You're looking at a building going, well, it's leaning to the left. So we really need to go back to the foundation and figure out why. And that has a lot to do with symmetry in parts. Are the vocals too wordy? Are they, is there good symmetry in the phrasing? Like, you know, we're making pop music here in my studio at the end of the day. It could be long form, but I'm not doing jazz, or this wouldn't apply to jazz or prog rock necessarily. I'm coming from a certain school, but I do offer this, I guess it's like a quality control of the design of the song and the parts. And what that does is it gets me through the composition. The composition is good, but now I need to get the song kind of ready for public presentation. And that's where this comes in, this whole process that I go through. Some of it, I go, we should add another chord here. So it does kind of go between songwriting and then this design, troubleshooting of the design of the song. And then we go to recording. So usually that's why my pre-production process is so lengthy and intense. And then recording is just executing what we've come up with.
Well, I guess it comes down to political skills too, in terms of, like you said, some jams went well, some jams didn't go so well. Say a band comes to you and they've written a song and they've been playing it the same way for 2 years. Do you get a lot of pushback?
Well, usually at that point, they've brought me in on purpose because they're feeling like it's hit a wall. So I'm usually pretty free from the band politics. But where I have found it to be challenging is when I play in other people's bands, like today, I just can't tolerate any amount of downtime of like, not sure what to do. It's like, because I always know what to do, or at least I always know what thing to say to get us to the point where we can, like, I may not know the answer, but I know, okay, if we do this, let's just try it. And we'll get there. I get really impatient when I'm playing with other bands. So I've had to kind of go into rehearsal where I'm not the band leader and just let them do it their way. It might take an extra 45 minutes or 2 hours, but I'm really impatient with that because I just like chop, chop, chop. No, why are we doing this? I don't understand why we're playing this one section over and over. It's not good. Let's just get rid of it. You know, like I'm just really like dismissive and impatient. So that's one thing that's funny. When I join another band, I notice that. So I don't have that problem when I'm producing because people look to me for support and advice. But when I'm in another band where I'm just not the band leader, like playing guitar, it's tricky.
Yeah. And to wrap up the benefit of the pre-prod, an example that I've seen more than a few times in terms of people come to the studio and say they're going to do a quick demo, and I've done a lot of that stuff, and you just come in and you bang out everything in a day or a few days. The importance of pre-prod for anyone listening here is the amount of times that I've seen a bass player or a guitar player say to another musician, "Oh, that's what you're playing there?" You know, like, so just,
or maybe the bass player does the is doing the either you're in D or something and the bass player is doing F and you're like, yeah, that's not in the same key,
and they've been playing the song
and then you
for
can't
months
hear it because it's so low on the neck, you just can't really tell
because they've been jamming it, right? So they've been just blasting away in their jam space or
it's,
rehearsing
there's
it,
always
so.
A descending thing on a bass when you're like, no, that's not the right scale, it's in the wrong key. Like I've seen that a few times, and it's usually like by fret around fret 1, 2, or 3, because you can't really hear when a bass run is wrong there. So you go, oh my god,
that's pretty funny.
It's always funny. Yeah.
One of the things I wanted to touch on with you too is funding. You have a bunch of experience in that, in terms of grants and maybe the Canadian government, but just funding in general and that whole process.
Funding is great. I've benefited from it with my band in Flight Safety, but as a producer, I don't really take part in it anymore because the bands have to take part in it. And also I have found it took me so much of my mental energy and effort to get the funding to keep the band going that I really just, in a way, I resented it in the end because it took so much time to get the money that I needed to do the video or do the thing. And it was all worth it, but it made the art kind of take a backseat so many times. So there's a ton of funding in this country. And I encourage all the bands to look it up because you have to do it. It's there. You can get money for records, for videos, and often provincially you can get money to promote your music export your music. So there's not only national funding bodies, there's provincial funding bodies that will also fund the marketing of your records. So there's just so much money to be had. You have to go for it, but it is very time consuming and you need someone in your band who can do it.
we've both been singers, lead songwriters in a bunch of the projects that we've been in, and you end up being that guy who takes on those roles, and I'm going to build a website, and I'm going to maybe look into the funding, and I'm going to record the band. And like you mentioned it, you end up resenting the process itself, and then maybe resenting the other band members as they go off and work at their jobs and make money or spend time with their loved ones. And do you have any tips and tricks in terms of making it a little easier for maybe someone in the band that's maybe wearing more hats than other people? And
yeah, that's a great question. And all your questions have been really good. It shows that you've, you know, been around so long. I do have another set of things I do with bands. Sometimes I do consulting for bands and I sit down with them and I'll be like, well, who's doing what? And it's like, okay, we need to recognize that this person is the day-to-day manager. Bands have managers who are more high-level macro people, but bands also have day-to-day managers. And we never talk about that in bands. And day-to-day management is really tough because it's draining. It's like organizing rehearsals. It's booking the flights. It's figuring out the tour routing and figuring out who's doing the funding. When I'm helping bands with stuff like that, I try to help them develop roles within the band. And then also to give that person who's doing the extra work, because now it's been identified, to give them more benefits. Let them have more money. It's crazy that we think that bands should be democratic, 50-50, 25, 25, 25, when like one person is clearly doing all the legwork. So I try to help them identify the roles. This person's booking the shows. Well, then they should get the 10% on the shows. I mean, not on everything. If this person's doing management, well, they should get the 15% management commission. If this person's doing day-to-day, well, then you need to pay them a monthly stipend. Because day-to-day management is the worst part. It's like everything. It's like getting the car fixed, booking the appointments, and booking the meetings, and oh my God. And I did that for years. And it's unsung because no one gets paid for it.
Yeah, it's an opportunity cost, right? For the whoever's fulfilling those roles, maybe many roles or maybe just some roles, but it's the opportunity cost of someone else, of how they could be spending their time.
That's right. So I try to make them recognize that. And that's been really helpful in helping bands develop more of a process in terms of who's doing what and identifying it. Because when you start, you don't really know about these things. And then later you find out, how did that band do all that stuff? You're like, oh, they have a day-to-day manager in an office somewhere. You're like, oh, okay, I get it. I didn't know how you did all that work in 1 year with one person. You know, like, you know, it's like there's all sorts of roles that are being fulfilled. And you don't have, I don't believe in this thing of like people say, you know, treat your band as a business. Sure, I get that. I say treat your band as a band, make art. That's really important to me. But then at some point, you do have to treat your band as a business. And that kind of stuff is important, developing roles and identifying them and then rewarding people for those roles. It's okay to be a bass player and just play bass. Like, that's totally fine. Why are people so hung up on the myth of being in a band? Or I've had conversations with people more than once that has been like, I can no longer pay my own personal money so that you can say you're in a band. And no hard feelings, but surely you can understand that. And, you know, oftentimes they do. So you've had to pare bands down to less membership because money is tight. But sometimes people don't see it that way. And they just kind of think, well, I'm in this band, aren't I? And you're like, well, are you? What are you doing?
Well, I think it's so smart that you have this process that you set up, because the art is the art and you do that thing. But there's the business side. If you choose to have a band that's giving a go and doing some sort of business related activities, it's not sexy to think about that. But if more bands, if it was like if you had to pass this test, like a driving license test or go through a series of things where it's like, okay, you need to learn how to write songs and play your instrument and be in a band with people, and to have this thing where you're assigning people different roles and acknowledging some of the work that people put in. Like, I think that's such a crucial thing that people have to figure out the hard way. And that's why so many bands break up. But having that discussion from the get-go, I think would help a lot more bands stick together and not break up.
It really would. But I'm have the privilege of having now, you know, almost 15 years in a band, and not only being in a band, consider that I've been around bands my whole adult life because I'm on tour with them. I see where things have gone wrong for other bands. Mm-hmm. We talk about it. We see the arguments. We've had our own arguments. And so I've been around that culture so long that I have the privilege of knowing, okay, well, this is something bands never do and they should. And you know, you get old and you get a bit cranky and you want things to go smoother and you kind of figure out ways to make that happen. And I apply the same thing to when I work with artists. I'll be like, hey, listen, I'm pitching your songs to some music supervisor. A, is that cool? B, here's what I would like from it. If we get a musical license like for film and TV, I'd like to be cut in on the master side. And this is what I was thinking. And they'd say yes or no. And so I do that stuff all up front because it's really time consuming to keep in touch with people and pitch the music and like, hit all my contacts up. And especially when I'm not in the bands I'm producing. So I always touch base with people and make sure they're cool with me doing things that are maybe a little bit supplementary to producing. But I do a lot of stuff like that too. I'm always very stringent on how my time's being used and how what they're paying for.
That makes perfect sense because there's no surprises.
There's no surprises. And hey, they can argue.
I pushed that song for you. And now that it's a success, well, I want this as my cut.
Yeah, and I never do that. And if I'm working on something too long, like we're say I'm doing too much management with the band, I'll just tell them. I'll say, like, hey, I feel like I'm doing a lot of work here. So what do you think? This is a strategy I learned from someone. I don't even remember who. It's I always ask the person a question. Like, what would you do? What would you have me do? Or what would you think is fair? Mm-hmm. And that works really well. As you put it to someone else, it's like, I've been working on this song for a year. I know I didn't write the original song, but I changed it so much in the production. What do you think is fair for SoCan? What would you like to offer me? And they might say 5%. And I just usually say yes. They might say 15%. I just say yes to whatever they offer. I work kind of in a weird way. But having been an artist so long, I don't like arguments about ownership. And I like to let the artist lead in terms of like when they're offering money for something in addition to producing or for when we're writing together, I kind of let them make the first offer. I've never really had it too low, so I never have to go back.
Yeah.
But I tend to like put it to other people. It's a good strategy of being like, what would you do in this situation? And they can easily go, okay, I can see that. So that's something that I've used, a strategy I've used a lot with my own bandmates and my friends and in music.
Communication is key.
Communication, big time.
I mean, it can be translated into any number of different parts of people's lives, but it makes so much sense when you're in a band because think about this more recently, and I mentioned it a few times to people, just maybe being in the startup world and the entrepreneurial world, but being in a band is like being an entrepreneur and doing your own startup. You're getting a bunch of people together. You're working for maybe free at the get-go, and you're bringing in resources and you're renting space to practice and you're putting together a product to sell because even if that dream is just to get a record deal, that's like you're cashing out when someone buys your startup and you get bought by a huge company, and then that's the payoff. So, you know, never thinking that I had much experience before I started working in startups and that kind of entrepreneurial world, say 4 or 5 years ago, but I'm like, oh yeah, a band is like a startup.
It totally is. You're absolutely right. And just being clear about who's doing what, and if you're not comfortable with something, just say it rather than wait. But that comes from the benefit of experience and the benefit of aging. You get a little bit more direct and you're not as worried about the consequences because you're in a different part stage in your life. So I try to instill that in the bands I work with. And to a degree, I think that's helps them as well. And being directed to the point about what you want to do. And there's always questions, you know, but I'm open to criticism. And I will also ask questions about if there isn't like a fair payment structure. I'll just mention, this is getting a little out of hand. What do you think? And then often it always is resolved right then and there.
Yeah, because some people might not even be tuned in. They might be sensitive to it after the fact that it's brought up, but they would have been tuned in and be like, oh, I just thought everything was going smoothly and hunky-dory. Yeah. And that's where I always thought that managers would be a good thing. And I've never had a manager in my career, but when you have money to deal with, you know, and the band at the end of the day and you're in the studio and be like, hey, how about that money? And it's just always a very awkward situation.
Yeah, you did definitely have to identify roles, and you yourself as a producer have to be aware of it, because if not, a lot of us have managers. Some of us do as producers. You got to be on top of it. And I've been traditionally pretty bad at it, but because in order to be in a band that long, you have to take a lot of risk. So I'm used to taking so much risk, but as a producer, I'm taking less of that kind of crazy risk and making sure everything's kind of financially sound. And I'll do the odd thing for free just because for friends and stuff. But then I always have conversations with my bands about things. But just recently, the most recent conversation I had was I do 50% deposits on each song I work on. And then I do the 50% at the end of delivery. When I deliver something, they have agreed is good.
Well, that's a smart way to do it because that enables you to not have to worry about how you're paying your bills while you're working on someone else's music.
That's right. So that's how I do it. And that also gives us, we won't start a record unless we're sure you want to work with me. And that also kind of gets punters and tire kickers out of the way, because if they're not going to start, they're not going to pony up a bunch of money, 50% deposit, if for some reason they're not interested. So it really serves a great purpose. I started doing that because that's how we did shows in a band. We just ask for 50% deposits and then collect the rest on the end of after the show. So I started seeing that as a valuable way to. And just recently, I had a conversation with an artist I'm working on, and she had paid me a deposit on something But the song just wasn't working out for either of us. So I just said, let's just tank it right there. And she was happy with that because she doesn't owe me another 50% of a bunch of money.
Yeah.
It wasn't a financially good idea for me to do that because I worked so long on it, but the song isn't working. So I don't want to finish it if she doesn't want to finish it. We just threw it off a cliff and just left it at the deposit and sort of took it as a loss for her and a loss for me. But it makes sense for the record not to have that song around. We're going to write some new ones or something. So, you know, there's conversations come up, things change, but just being direct and stuff has really helped me in my old age for sure.
Sweet. I think we could continue going on for ages, and I think we've touched on most of the things.
Enough,
maybe we'll have to have another, have you on the podcast again, definitely further down the line. One of the questions that I had that I wanted to ask, though, just for fun, you're from the East Coast of Canada, what we call the Maritimes, a collection of provinces over there, and you guys have a reputation down there.
We do? Okay. All right. Here we go.
Of everyone being very nice. So my question to you, is everyone from the Maritimes really nice?
I think so. I mean, I also think everyone everywhere is very nice, like from my travels, including New York and Austin, Texas. So, I do think Canadians are super nice. And I think you'll find a different vibe in Montreal versus Halifax. But Montreal is in Montreal, right? It is what it is. But it's funny. I think like Newfoundland would be the nicest place you'll ever find. Like you could be walking down a road in St. John's at 1 p.m. in the day and be kind of like maybe walking back from Signal Hill on your own. Someone will offer to drive you back into town. That will just happen. So Newfoundland definitely wins the prize for. And we all have to acknowledge and recognize what Newfoundland did for 9/11. So like that's just Newfoundland. I mean, holy crap. And let all these people they don't know into every single one's home, landed about like 15 commercial aircraft at a tiny airport and made it all happen. And Newfoundland would win the prize for me, but I do think the Maritimes is super friendly. But I also think, I don't want to be dismissive of other places in the world I've been. They've all been friendly.
I would agree with you. I've spent a lot of time down in the Maritimes over my life, and I love it down there, and I still feel a kinship. Anytime anyone brings it up, I will definitely mention that I live there. For a while, and I still have really close friends, and you'd have to be at the top of that list. You're a great ambassador to the Maritimes.
Well, I have to say the same thing for you. I'm glad we met when we were kids. It's been a great friendship.
I'm glad at least that you know one nice person from Montreal. Well, thanks a lot for coming on, John, and we'll have to talk soon.
Okay, I'm glad we got to chat.
Well, that's it, folks. Thanks for listening. Tune in next time. If you'd like to reach John, you can use the contact page at inflightsafety.ca. His Instagram is InFlightJohn and Twitter, John Mullane. Please subscribe on your favorite podcasting app and give us a solid rating and review on iTunes. If you want to find out more about the show, visit unfamouspodcast.com. Facebook and Instagram is unfamouspodcast and Twitter is unfamouspod, but f*** Twitter. Theme music for Unfamous Podcast is provided by The Pines. Thanks, guys. All of the music for this episode is courtesy of InFlight Safety.
I still have those moments where it's, I'm a parent.
Yeah, I have it all the time. Still coming home from work and I'm like, okay, yeah, I'm just listening to a podcast. Yeah. Kids, I got to focus up here. It's really all about sleep because once you're a parent, everything's crazy anyway, whatever. Two kids, one kid, it's crazy. I find I'm really I've always been this way, focused on like marks. Like, okay, hit this mark, child to bed, child in the bath, feed the child, get him to daycare. So I just hit marks and sometimes I forget like, I'm a dad. I'm not just a guy taking care of this kid.
I'm not just a project manager managing.
Yeah. I kind of do project management because it's how I run my life. It's like, I got to get this done and it has to happen. I also find like all my, and we're going to talk about some of them. I think, my accomplishments with this band and my musical journey kind of becomes meaningless sometimes in the wake of having two children or having a child. You know what I mean? It's hard to grapple with that, to be honest. And people are like, you did all this stuff with your band, eh? And I go, yeah, I don't really care because it got me where I wanted to go, I think, to a degree. But when you're thinking about the scope of things, it doesn't. It's just stuff, Like, you did some stuff, but it's like, are you a good father is way more important to me.
Absolutely. It's like, stuff, how do I make sure that this kid still has a healthy supply of strawberries in the morning?
Yeah. And I'm very passionate about music, and you are too, and you know this. So it's weird to say it. as the one guy, you might expect to never say that. I'm saying it too. So yeah. Something happens for sure.